Topic number two. The radically new Phantom warplane is causing an equally radical revision of the master war strategy of the United States. Elements of several past strategies are now being blended together to create a new grand plan. It is this new grand master strategy which America's war planners are counting on to bring them victory in Nuclear War I. And they plan to use the war plan very soon, by the autumn of this year, 1982. Strategic nuclear war planning here in Washington is now being carried out under the code name Project Z. The letter Z was chosen because it is the final letter in the alphabet. The war planners here are confident that this is the last war plan they will need against Russia. War planning under Project Z is so secret that it's not being done at the Pentagon itself. Instead, an elite group of war strategists have been assembled at a special war room in downtown Washington. The war room is hidden away in a building which would never be suspected for the purpose. It's practically within the shadow of the White House. The elite war planners for Nuclear War I constitute a very small group. Their job is to think in terms of the big picture. They have at their fingertips computer terminals with which they can access any information they need from other government computers. This includes not only Pentagon data banks, but also the computer files of other government agencies. As I say these words, the Project Z war planners have already arrived at the broad outlines for their master war plan. Countless details and refinements still lie ahead, but the basic strategy is already decided. That strategy is what I am about to reveal to you. The Project Z strategy for Nuclear War I is a three-phase plan. That is, the war planners intend for the war to proceed in three distinct phases. These phases are known as Phase 1, Initiation, Phase 2, Attrition, and Phase 3, Domination. In past reports, I've given many details about the process which is to lead up to the coming war. That process is based on ever-increasing world crises, like those that led up to World War I. We are now seeing that process in full swing all around us. Within 6 months from now, these deliberate crises are supposed to provide the spark to set off Nuclear War I. The Project Z war planners are concerned with the military acts from that initial spark onward. Phase 1 in their plan, the initiation phase, will begin with an American surprise attack against Russia. The surprise attack will use the new Phantom warplanes. They will be the key to the outcome of the rest of the war. Some 3.5 years ago, in the summer of 1978, I reported that America was shifting to a first-strike nuclear strategy against Russia. In Audio Letter 37, I described the prime objective of any such American first strike. It will be to knock out the Earth bases for Russia's space triad of strategic weapons. If that can be done, Russia's overwhelming military power in space will soon wither and die. That will leave the United States and Russia on more equal terms for the rest of the war. When I recorded Audio Letter 37, the plan was to use a combination of subcraft and unmanned aircraft called RPVs for the initial attack. That plan was actually attempted over 2 years ago, as I reported in Audio Letters 53 and 54. It ended in total failure because subcraft and RPVs were no match for Russia's Cosmospheres with their beam weapons. But now, the new Phantom warplanes are almost ready, and the plan is being revived in updated form. Phantom warplanes are intended to be based in at least three countries on Russia's doorstep. These basing areas are northern Norway, eastern Turkey, and most critical of all, Sinkiang Province and northwestern China. Already, high-power lasers are being moved into those areas. They are equipped with a new aiming device called CEIR, SEER, which I described last month. These lasers have the proven ability to shoot down cosmospheres. They will be used to protect the phantom warplanes from destruction on the ground by Cosmospheres. The phantom warplanes which will be used are unmanned. They are equipped with robot pilots which can be programmed to fly each plane to a pre-assigned target. Each will be programmed for a one-way trip. The invisible robot-piloted aircraft will fly through Russian airspace, invulnerable to any beam weapon attacks. Anti-aircraft missiles fired at them will be unable to hone in on them. And so the Project Z planners believe that the robot phantom planes will reach their targets. Those targets are Russia's four Cosmodromes for rockets, plus several Cosmosphere installations in central Siberia. The invisible robot planes will crash like kamikazes into their targets. Seemingly out of a clear blue sky, all of Russia's space bases will suddenly vanish in thermonuclear fireballs. In addition to Russia's space bases, the phantom warplane assault will also be directed at one other category of prime targets. Those are the bases for Russia's flying anti-missile system, which I described in Audio Letter 54. The system consists of a fleet of Tu-144 supersonic transports equipped with particle beam weapons. They are supposed to provide Russia's final line of defense against incoming missile warheads. American Phantom warplanes will be programmed to destroy the Tu-144 bases. Phase 1 of the Project Z war plan continues on a very tight timetable. If the invisible warplane attack succeeds, a furious counterattack by Russia is guaranteed. Project Z calls for the United States to beat Russia to the punch. In Audio Letter 66 last summer, 1981, I revealed the plan by which America's entire nuclear arsenal is to be fired at Russia. It will be done by creating a false indication that America is under nuclear attack. The method which will be employed is known as electromagnetic pulse, or EMP. EMP is a phenomenon associated with nuclear blasts at the fringes of space. As I reported in Audio Letter 66, our strategic forces are being programmed to consider an EMP episode to be positive proof of a Russian attack. Under those circumstances, they are instructed to counterattack against Russia without waiting for any further orders. In the Project Z timetable, the phantom warplane explosions in Russia will be followed moments later by nuclear detonations over North America. These will be the warheads of American high-speed missiles called ACMs. They will be launched into the sky from various locations around the United States to create a violent EMP episode. Our strategic nuclear forces, obeying orders, will launch what they will believe to be retaliation against Russia. As the American ACMs are launched into the sky over our heads, still another event is to be underway. Last month I reported that a Russian Cosmosphere had been shot down for the first time in January over New Jersey. In the same way, high-power lasers located in many places around the United States will be shooting down as many Cosmospheres as possible. By the time our ICBMs are launched a few minutes later, it's expected that many of the threatening Cosmospheres overhead will have been destroyed. They will be unable to blast all of our missiles as they are launched, and many will survive to be on their way to Russia. Thanks to the initial phantom warplane attack, Russia's flying ABM system will also be out of action. Stripped of all her defenses against missile attack, the Soviet Union will soon be aflame with a sea of nuclear firestorms. In the Project Z war plan, the arrival of American ICBMs on Russian targets marks the end of Phase 1 of the war, the initiation phase. Next comes Phase 2, the attrition phase. During Phase 2, the war planners here envision extreme damage to both the United States and Russia, with the war gradually running down. First, there will be a rain of Russian missile warheads on the United States. There will also be missile attacks on certain other targets around the world where American military forces are located. But the real destruction will be right here in the United States itself. The Project Z war planners do not expect America, as we know it, to survive a nuclear exchange. Unlike Russia, the United States has no civil defense worthy of the name, let alone hardened blast shelters. And because of the need for total surprise in the attack against Russia's space bases, the ensuing nuclear exchanges will come without warning. Vacationers will be on beaches. Businessmen will be making deals. Housewives will be in supermarkets. Children will be at play. Suddenly, air raid sirens may start to blare, as they did on a summer day in Hiroshima 36 years ago. But it will be too late. The America we know and love will die in 1,000 Hiroshimas. The war schemers have planned for all that. While you and I and our children vanish from the face of the earth, they intend to be riding out the attack they have caused in government war bunkers. Gradually, over a period of many months, they expect the conflict between Russia and the United States to sputter out. Both sides will be exhausted and ruined. Both will lose the capacity to carry the war any further. In Russia, the wounds will be grievous, up to 50 million dead and millions more injured. But in the United States, the wounds will be mortal. The Project Z war planners have figured it out on their computers. If we are lucky, from 40 to 50 million Americans may survive at the end of Nuclear War I. All the rest will have been killed outright in nuclear attacks, or will have died of injuries and disease. Nuclear War I will leave medical care virtually non-existent in what is left of America. The American Bolsheviks here intend to ride out the war after setting it off. They will wait until the stalemate point is reached, with both sides unable to fight any longer. That will mark the end of Phase 2, the attrition phase. Finally, the Project Z war plan will move into the third and final phase. That phase is world domination by the satanic Bolsheviks who now control the United States military. In this final phase, the Bolsheviks here in America will be taking advantage of secret preparations which began long ago. In Audio Letter 28, I describe the two-pronged strategy for world domination which the four Rockefeller brothers launched in 1961. One side of this twin strategy required the United States to give the impression that it was growing steadily weaker, disarming unilaterally. But that was only for public consumption. The secret side of the strategy involved an actual buildup of armaments in secret. When the Bolsheviks here seized power from the Rockefellers, they continued the stockpiling of secret reserves of armaments worldwide. When Nuclear War I sputters out into exhausted stalemate, they plan to bring these secret reserves of military power into the open. Even if the entire populations of the United States and Russia are gone, that will still leave 95% of the world's population alive. With the world's only surviving major military force, they believe world domination will be theirs at last. Topic number 3. Yesterday morning, March 30, Space Shuttle Flight number 3 officially ended, one day behind schedule. For the first time, we got to see a shuttle landing at the White Sands Missile Range, New Mexico. As I detailed last year in Audio Letter 64, White Sands is the true nerve center of the space shuttle program. This third shuttle flight also chalked up another first, and this one was not visible on television. For the first time, my friends, a space shuttle has succeeded in its secret military mission. By doing so, the shuttle has removed one more barrier to nuclear war. The accelerated war planning now underway here in Washington will be able to proceed even faster thanks to the space shuttle. The third shuttle mission took place nearly 1 year after the first flight of April 1981. A comparison between the first and third flights is a study in ironies. Last April, publicity about the first flight was designed to give the impression that it was unnaturally perfect. Meanwhile, the secret military mission, which we did not see, was a disaster. This time, on flight number 3, it was the other way around. From start to finish, the publicity emanating from NASA gave the impression that the shuttle was plagued with problems. NASA wanted to be able to explain it away if disaster should strike again. But as it turned out, the military mission in space, hidden from our eyes, was a success. In Audio Letter 72 last month, I described what that mission was. Space Shuttle No. 3 was supposed to orbit a special new spy satellite, which I described last year in Audio Letter 62. It is hardened against attack from Russia's space weapons and armed with a robot-controlled laser that can shoot back. In addition, the shuttle itself was armed with lasers this time, as I detailed last month. The public image of a troubled plague shuttle flight actually got underway several days before launch, thanks to the weather. Drenching rainstorms turned Edwards Air Force Base in California, used for the first two shuttle landings, into a soggy mess. The tight military schedule of the shuttle program required that the flight take off on schedule anyway. So for public consumption, a 23-car railroad train loaded with equipment was sent from California to New Mexico. Ostensibly, NASA was setting up a spur-of-the-moment landing site at the White Sands Missile Range. This was done so that the central role of White Sands in the shuttle program would not be suspected by the public. Space Shuttle No. 3 lifted off from Cape Canaveral only an hour behind schedule on Monday morning, March 22nd. Beginning at the moment of liftoff, NASA started laying the bases for a cover-up story should the military mission fail. First, we heard the pre-recorded voice of Shuttle Commander Jack Lausma saying unexplained white flicks were flying past the windshield. Later, after the shuttle was out of sight, we were told that one of the power packs, called an APU, was malfunctioning. These initial hints of possible trouble had been pre-recorded for broadcast during the launch for a reason. There was fear that the shuttle might be destroyed by Russian space weapons before reaching orbit. Had that happened, the shuttle managers wanted to be able to initiate a cover-up which would not reveal the military situation. But as it turned out, the preparations which I detailed last month were successful. Shuttle No. 3 did reach orbit successfully, and a key to success was a radical new maneuver added to the flight plan. When Space Shuttle 3 took off last week, it headed into the northeast. Long-distance cameras followed it until the two solid rockets separated and fell away. Then, as the shuttle disappeared from sight, it started its long, sweeping turn into the north. It was heading toward a near-polar orbit so that it would pass over Russia. This much of the flight plan was the same as in the past. But this time, a critical new feature was added. Less than 30 seconds after the shuttle disappeared from TV cameras, the cargo bay doors were blasted off. This opened up a field of fire for the defensive laser at the front of the cargo bay, which I discussed in Audio Letter 72. Then the shuttle and its giant external tank started rotating slowly in a space-age version of a barrel roll. In World War II, fighter pilots made use of the barrel roll to avoid bullets from enemy airplanes. Likewise, the space shuttle this month used a barrel roll to protect itself against possible attack from Russian cosmospheres. By rotating like a corkscrew, the shuttle made it impossible for a cosmosphere to approach safely from any direction. The barrel roll maneuver was a very risky one for the shuttle. The shuttle and tank were never designed with such aerobatics in mind. But calculations showed that it should survive a slow roll, and it did. One of the biggest questions about the barrel roll stunt was what it would do to the astronauts, Lausma and Fullerton. They were required to withstand these dizzying gyrations for about 6 minutes. At the same time, the shuttle was still accelerating with up to 3 times the force of gravity. And because of the peculiar design of the shuttle and fuel tank, the gyrations were sickening indeed. Military space doctors knew that at best, Lausma and Fullerton would be very sick for some time after reaching orbit. Their wild, crushing, spinning ride would end abruptly in weightlessness. That is a combination guaranteed to derange the equilibrium of even the toughest astronaut. Nothing remotely like it had ever been done in space before. Doctors were worried that even if Lausma and Fullerton survived the mission and returned to Earth, there could be permanent damage to their equilibrium. When Lousma and Fullerton reached orbit, they did indeed become violently ill. That's why we heard those reports about nausea striking both men. NASA wanted to pave the way for a plausible public explanation if they should not appear well when they returned to Earth. At the same time, the shuttle planners knew perfectly well why they were sick. That is why NASA spokesmen acted so unconcerned when discussing the space sickness with reporters. When they called it motion sickness, quote-unquote, they were making an understatement. When I recorded Audio Letter 72 last month, I reported that the plan was for Lousma and Fullerton to begin work immediately upon reaching orbit. Their extensively modified crew compartment was to be depressurized already, with the two men depending upon their spacesuits. This plan had to be modified slightly when the barrel roll was added to the flight plan. When the shuttle reached orbit, the astronauts were in spacesuits, but the cabin was still pressurized. They were allowed several minutes to get from the flight deck to the Gemini-type escape capsule stored below. Once inside the escape capsule, they depressurized the cabin. Then the nose laser system deployed automatically to protect the shuttle against any attacks by Russian space weapons. This allowed Lousma and Fullerton to recover from space sickness inside the capsule. For the next 24 hours or so, getting well was their main task. It was a period of vulnerability, of depending on the untried automatic laser system for protection. The shuttle planners wanted to have an excuse ready later should the shuttle be attacked and destroyed. So the day after the launch, we were shown TV pictures of missing tiles on the nose of the shuttle. According to those pictures, my friends, at least a dozen tiles in the black area were lost. If that had really happened, it would have been cause for great alarm. Later on, NASA spokesman downplayed it, saying the tiles were non-critical. But there is no such thing as a non-critical black tile. The black tiles supposedly lost are to withstand temperatures above 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit. Under the tile, there is nothing but a piece of felt called a strain isolation pad. It would not last 5 seconds in those temperatures. And under the felt is the metal skin of the shuttle. It is made of aluminum, which loses its strength above 350 degrees. If exposed to 1,500 degree heat by a few missing black tiles, the shuttle could not possibly avoid severe damage. The NASA space movies we saw on TV were a pre-recorded hoax to provide an excuse if something went wrong, but it did not. The astronauts recovered, went to work, and deployed the new military satellite. Meanwhile, NASA spokesman waved aside the alleged tile problem as minor. It had served its purpose and was no longer needed. Throughout the rest of the week, we heard about one problem after another. Supposedly, the cargo bay doors would not close. The toilet would not work. 3 out of 4 communication channels went out. 1 of the 3 crucial data display screens in the cockpit failed. None of these stories were true. All were devised to provide a cover story for possible problems with a secret mission, but in the end, none of them were needed. And so NASA spokesman just waved them aside as unimportant. The secret military mission was a success. So the pretended mission, which was cooked up for TV, was declared a success too. Late Friday night, March 26, Lousma and Fullerton finished deploying the new Super Spy satellite. It had taken longer than planned, but it was done. As I explained last month, they left their shuttle in orbit. They re-entered their Gemini-type escape capsule, fired its retro rockets, and dropped out of orbit to an Indian Ocean splashdown. From there, they were flown nonstop to the White Sands Missile Range, New Mexico. The shuttle managers took advantage of a sandstorm at White Sands to delay the public landing for 1 extra day while the astronauts recuperated. Then yesterday morning, they boarded 1 of the 2 remaining secret shuttles at White Sands. The shuttle took off from the north end of the immense White Sands range using small solid rockets. Moments before 11 a.m., it made its appearance on TV. It swooped in from the north, dropped down over the mountains, and touched down in a cloud of white dust. Finally, after a respectable wait, out stepped Lousma and Fullerton, rested and refreshed. My friends, Like every other American, I find myself wanting to cheer at the success of Space Shuttle Flight No. 3. It was achieved against incredible odds in the face of Russia's overwhelming power in space. Determination, ingenuity, and sheer boldness carried the day. That is how I am tempted to feel. But then I have to recall the ultimate purpose of all this. The military shuttle managers are not doing these things to prevent war, but to prepare to fight one. The success of Space Shuttle 3, my friends, has brought us a giant step closer to thermonuclear war. Now it's time for my last-minute summary. In this audio letter, I reported on major developments now taking place in our headlong rush into nuclear war. The United States has developed a new secret superweapon, the Invisible Phantom Warplane. Its invulnerability to beam weapons makes it the centerpiece of a whole new war strategy against Russia. This strategy, codenamed Project Z, involves an American surprise attack on Russia followed by all-out war. Until now, the main weakness of the war plan has been the lack of fresh reconnaissance data on Russia. But now, that problem is rapidly being solved. Last month, I reported a major intelligence coup against Russia by the war planners here. And now the success of Space Shuttle 3 is adding to the momentum for nuclear war. My friends, for many years now, our Lord Jesus Christ has held back the Holocaust that threatens to engulf us. Time after time, we have come to the very brink, only to be pulled back and spared once again. Our Lord is not willing that any should perish, and He has shown us mercy over and over. But what have we, as a nation, done in response to that mercy?
Have we mended our ways, returned to Him, and revived the values that made America great?
The answer, my friends, is found in the words of the prophet Jeremiah, chapter 5. We have spoken falsely of the Lord, and have said He will do nothing. No evil will come upon us, nor shall we see sword or famine. Behold, I am bringing upon you a nation from afar, says the Lord. It is an enduring nation. It is an ancient nation, a nation whose language you do not know. My friends, our satanic Bolshevik leaders here intend to destroy the ancient, enduring nation of Russia, whose language we do not know. But our Lord Jesus Christ sees all, and He alone will repay. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.